Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Ian Pescod, and he's from Panama, teaching in Panama, and he is an author of a book, and he reached out to me recently, and the title of the book is Losing Touch, and I thought it would be really interesting because it seems like our stories are quite parallel, and so I wanted to have him on the show, learn a little bit about the book and a little bit about its backstory. So Ian, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Taylor. It's really an honor.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about you. Let's talk a little bit about the background. So tell me where you're from. I mean, are you from Panama?
My family's from here. I was born in Uruguay in South America. But I've lived here pretty much all my life, and all my relatives are from here.
Gotcha. Yeah. And what kind of kid were you like in high school and college?
I was really into music when I was in high school and college. I was what is known as like straight edge in like punk rock terminology, you can say.
Sure. I wasn't. You had the X's?
I didn't go that far. I didn't like to be called a straight edge either. I just didn't like to drink or do any drugs or any of that. We were just happy playing music and playing shows and recording and rehearsing and all that stuff. That was kind of our drug.
Yeah. And why were you drawn to like straight edge?
I guess that was popular at that time. And I would keep hearing that term straight edge and then just inquiring into what it was. It's like, okay, it's these guys that just don't drink, don't do drugs, and they put X's on their hands. And I'm like, okay, I mean, I relate to that. I just, you know, don't want to label myself in any way or like put X's on my hand. I'm comfortable doing it.
Sure. Yeah. And how old were you like when you kind of fell into that culture?
I was maybe like 17, 18. I mean, I started with music earlier, maybe 16, 15, around there.
Okay.
And then I started with a band in high school, it was like this type of rock band project that we had. And then that evolved into another band as I started to get into college. So yeah, those were my high school and college years. I was totally driven to like live off of music and become a rock musician, basically.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so when you got out of college, is that what you fell into? Did you start playing for rock bands?
I was with the same rock band. We graduated from college and we recorded an album in Maryland, in Baltimore. The bass player of this band, called Gargage, he was touring the U.S. with another band that he had, right, when he was in college, and he ended up meeting a whole bunch of people from the scene and producers and stuff, and he was passing around our demos, and then one of the producers just took an interest and said, all right, I would be down to recording you guys. So we ended up going there after college, recording the album, promoting it for a while here in Panama. And then everybody just kind of drifted into their real jobs, into their real lives, you can say.
Sure. I mean, that I feel like that kind of what's naturally happens. Like the band thing, you know, is like a dream for a lot of people. But then they like the amount of work that it takes in order to put yourself out there continuously and touring and, you know, just the creation of the CD or the, you know, the albums and stuff like that are just, I mean, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, a lot of work. And I was really, for some reason, I was the only one who was like had my full drishti on that dream of being a musician. I had no plan B, really. I mean, I took a business degree because I studied marketing because I thought, you know, in any case, marketing is what's going to help me in the music business. So I got out of college with that. Sure. And all the work I was doing was just to, you know, buy equipment and save for the recording and to pay for rehearsal costs and stuff like that. I mean, we were getting paid to play, but that, you know, barely covered the expenses that we were undergoing. So everyone just kind of drifted into their plan B, but I was the only one that didn't have one. And that's where we could say, like, the existential crisis really kicked in. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, tell me a little bit about. I mean, I know, like, I read a little parts of your book. I haven't read, full disclosure, I haven't read the whole thing, mm-hmm. But it's really intriguing because a lot of you know, our stories kind of like parallel, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, I read your book while I was in Mysore, actually. That's where I got it. I forgot the name of the store, but it's the bookstore there. And yeah, I definitely saw a lot of, you know, a lot of myself reflected in your story, and I really liked your vulnerability, and that was a big inspiration behind what I wrote as well. Just seeing that there's people out there doing these types of things. But well, to get into this existential crisis part of my life, it was kind of during my mid-20s. Already during college, I had started trying out weed, marijuana, and by my mid-20s, I was experimenting with psychedelics. I was reading a lot of stuff on, like, the Tibetan Book of Dead that Timothy Leary and, or I think it was Terence McKenna, one of those two, that they were writing. Yeah. And relating it to the psychedelic experience. And I read Steve Jobs' autobiography by Walter. Sure. Isaacson, and just saw how influential his early experimentation with psychedelics was, and just kind of breaking out of paradigms and stuff. So I was kind of interested in that because I really was looking for something, you know, mystical. I feel like music was that, like, escape from reality, right? In a way that I was looking for. And then when that carpet was pulled under my feet, I didn't have any escape. So I guess the escapes that I chose were more of a destructive nature, right?
Sure. And I can relate to that for sure.
Yeah. And yeah, the thing is, like, and this is something that I talk about in the book, I don't feel like I had, like, one overarching main addiction. What I feel is that I had a whole bunch of, like, what I call micro addictions. And I feel that mm-hmm. is something a little bit more common than we'd like to acknowledge, you know, as a society. And the reason I say it is because your book, you know, you talked about really strong addiction, I guess strong in the sense that it can be very destructive, that it's clearly obvious, like, how destructive this substance is. And just reading about, you know, the physiological effects, the psychological effects, everything that was happening around your life, it's a very destructive thing. And, you know, these kinds of addictions are a bit easier, or yeah, easier to point out, like, okay, this is clearly destructive, but there's so many others. You know, in my case, I was smoking weed, I was drinking alcohol, I was watching porn, masturbating, going with prostitutes, you know, all these things that none of them were really over, none of them were really like strong or pointing out, but they mm-hmm. were all still there, you know, and they were all kind of intermingled. And I realized that, okay, I kind of have a problem here.
Yeah. Well, and so, but how, like, what was the thought process between, like, being involved in the, you know, kind of the culture of, like, straight edge to all of a sudden, like, smoking weed, experimenting with psychedelics, like, you know, prostitutes, like, I mean, like, what was that switch? Like, how did you rationalize that in your head?
That's a pretty cool question. When I was in college, I studied abroad. I went to the U.S. I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and of all places. And and then, I mean, there's this university here that has a program with the University of Louisville, and so a lot of Panamanians were there. And sure. So I had, you know, kind of this little Panamanian community, and they were all different to the people that I hung out with while I was here. So I was in, you know, in this new environment, new circumstances, new friends all around me. And for a long time, I kind of resisted it. I didn't want to get too involved with them because I was still kind of holding on to my straight edge mentality. Like, no, I don't want to go out partying, because that's what they did. I mean, that's what, yeah. That's what a lot of Panamanians that live in the city do, you know, it's just,
I mean, that's what a lot of college exactly. students do as well. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So I was resisting it. I was going to the gym. I was working on my music. I was just stuck in my dorm room recording guitar tracks, recording vocals, drum tracks. I was producing a lot of music. And then, you know, one day I'm just like, one of my friends said, hey, you should come out. You're so antisocial. Everybody wants to hang out with you. So I started just little by little getting more and more involved. And to me, it was like, you know what? Like, fuck it. I'm going to do the stuff that I haven't been doing, you know, I'm not living under my parents' roof anymore. I have a whole different set of friends. This is a whole new environment. So let me just give this, you know, the benefit of the doubt. Let me try out what this is all about.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you put your guard down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a big way, I did.
And I mean, once you put that guard down, I mean, did you sort of immediately feel like you were drawn to that? Like once you did the first smoking of the weed, first like drinking of the alcohol, like did you feel like you're just like barriers come down and you're like, I want to do this all the time?
Yeah.
Like, was that how your addiction was, or was it not like that?
It definitely was. It definitely was like that. I mean, I took a liking to marijuana pretty immediately. And alcohol as well. I mean, obviously, I didn't like being hungover and stuff, but I just liked how much more social it made me, you know, how much less awkward I felt when I was drinking and around people, because without that, I was, you know, kind of a pretty introverted and awkward guy. So this was kind of a means of facilitating this process of opening up to these new people.
Gotcha. So like, you know, you basically went from like someone who was very introverted to all of a sudden like you're drinking and stuff and you feel like you're part of the crew.
Yeah.
Or part of the party.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, it's a slippery slope though,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, you know, so I'd ask you, you know, because I can obviously relate to a lot of what you just said. I mean, how bad did it get? You know, because you talked about like micro addictions.
Yeah.
You know, like, are you saying with these micro addictions, are you actually saying that like you didn't have like this kind of, you know, terrible things that happened to me? Or is it sort of like you did have those things, but you had all of these other addictions as well?
I guess what, like, if I had like a rock bottom experience is kind of what you're asking.
Sure.
I feel like I didn't have like a rock bottom experience in the sense that I, you know, maybe like crashed a car and destroyed it completely, or, you know, hurt anyone, maybe while I was under the influence of stuff, or caused any like major damage. I think really the rock bottom experiences were more of a psychological nature, just how bad I felt with myself and how uneasy I was with what I was doing, and just seeing that I was powerless to change it, basically. I feel like psychedelics had a big role there, and not necessarily, you know, the you know, the positive experiences with psychedelics, but the bad trips. The bad trips really brought to the surface how unstable I was emotionally, and how much my mind had control over me, how my mind was such like this powerful. And when I say my mind, I'm probably referring just to my ego, you know, its wants and its sure. desires, and just wanting this gratification instantly all the time. And I just realized how during the psychedelic trips, how powerless I was to that.
Gotcha. And so did you struggle with depression or anxiety, or like, you know, what kind of things, or like, you know, like you say, like you're, you know, like the psychedelics and like your emotional body is kind of like what you're talking about. Like what kind of state was it in most of the time?
Definitely depressive. And like I say, you know, Taylor, this is some of these things are not always very evident. You know, I was never like clinically depressed. I was never, you know, I never saw a psychiatrist. I just had this kind of lingering sadness, and I would be, you know, working in advertising and having to go to the bathroom because I just needed to like cry. And I didn't know why, because I don't know, my life didn't make any sense or something, you know, and that just didn't feel like normal, you know, because then I would come out of the bathroom. I'm like shattered, and everybody's just doing their work happily, or I don't know, at least it seemed to me that they were doing their work happily, but it was, you know, a pretty positive atmosphere. And I'm like, why am I the one with a problem with all of this? Why am I uneasy with this?
Yeah. Do you think that maybe you should have seen a psychiatrist at that point?
Probably. Yeah. Probably so. But that's around the same time that I started getting into yoga. After one of those.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
After one of those really bad trips, really the thought that stayed in my mind was like, I want to Google how to control my mind. That's what I Googled. And then that started bringing up a bunch of results about Buddhism, about meditation, about Zen. So I really got into this kind of svadhyaya, you know, the self-inquiry and seeing, okay, what can I do about my situation, and looking up the available resources, because I didn't really want to ring any alarms as well, you know. I didn't want my family to be worried about me, but I knew something was wrong. But If I really dedicated myself, if I really had the intention to change, I could. So I started just self-inquiring. And that's a big topic in my book as well, right? The topic of self-inquiry. And my dad actually had a book on his bookshelf. It was literally called How to Meditate. So my dad is he's a recovering alcoholic. He's, to this day, he's still involved in AA. He's kind of the one that introduces the newcomers to the 12 steps, and he does like seminars and stuff. So he's really into this topic. And that book that he had was from the work he was doing with AA, and it was called How to Meditate. So I picked up that book and I just started practicing to sit down and meditate. And then
how'd that go for you?
it definitely started to work on me, for sure. I would sometimes start crying, or I would start feeling more peace, and kind of developing the skill of observing my thoughts and not associating so strongly with them, but being able to kind of observe them with this type of detachment. So that's what started to happen with meditation. And all of this was before any type of asana. I realized that I would need asana when I would feel that, you know, my back was hurting or that my legs were falling asleep. And then, you know, just continuing to read, because I never stopped reading. I would practice and just look, go book after book, reading other people's stories as well, other authors that inspired me to write the one that I wrote, like Noah Levine and Brad Warner, like these Zen Buddhist punk rockers who had this really troubled youth as well and found meditation. So I was kind of, you know, indirectly, you can say, reaching out to people who were, who I could identify with, who went through similar processes. Yep. And then that led me into reading about Hatha Yoga and how asanas were just a means of preparing the body for meditation. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. My body wasn't prepared for meditation. I mean, I got some benefits, but maybe I can take this a little further. And then that, that got me into the realm of asanas.
Gotcha. And so what was your first experience like with the asanas?
With asanas, I started with Vini Yoga. Three teachers that had a studio nearby where I was working, and this very gentle Hatha Yoga practice. And then we would always end with meditation, and I could see how they were related, how my body and mind would feel more prepared to enter in that kind of meditative state without so much resistance. So I started benefiting from that. And I guess, I mean, then I switched jobs. I switched over to another ad agency, and I kind of left yoga when that happened because there wasn't anything nearby. And there was like this corporate plan for a gym that was like literally 5 meters from where I was working. So I just started hitting the gym, doing my running, and still doing a couple of sun salutations and stuff. But around that time...
But were you still meditating though at that time?
I was, but not as committedly as before. I mean, whereas before I was doing every day, I came down to like once a week or something. Sometimes not even that. It just kind of drifted off. For some reason, when I stopped having a teacher, basically... to kind of hold me accountable, it just kind of dropped off. And I figured like, you know, okay, things are kind of balancing out. I wasn't as existential. I can kind of continue my work of fitting into society, being a good employee, being a good executive, et cetera. And things were kind of working out. But I was still, you know, noticing certain patterns that were still present in me, in my mind, that I still had no control over.
Yeah, well, like what kind of patterns are you in?
Like, for example, and this is a scene from the book, every Friday where I was working, you know, management would put a cooler with beers for the entire office to drink. It was like a custom, you know, Fridays, end of the day, end of the work week, everybody gets beers. So I would start drinking a couple of beers, finish up any pending tasks, and then getting out and then having this strong, strong urge to just go to a brothel and have sex with a prostitute. And that was like non-negotiable. That was like this instinctive, primitive drive, like, okay, I need to go do this. And then, you know, driving at a maniac speed to get to the brothel and having this police stop, this kind of police check. They checked the alcohol. I had to pay them $20 to let me go by because it was just barely above the mark. And just continuing, just all right, fuck it. I got past the police. Let's keep doing this. And these kind of instinctive drives, basically.
It's pretty raw that, you know, I've had several raw conversations on the podcast, but it's pretty raw for someone like yourself to like kind of own up to that kind of behavior, I feel like, you know. So how did you get to a place of where you felt like you were comfortable enough to share that and not be ashamed of it?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess through the yoga, the self-inquiry, the meditation, etc., I think what became very clear to me was how unhealthy my relationship to sex, firstly, and to women was. How unhealthy my relationship to women, because you know this more than a lot of people. The way addiction works, you know, the threshold starts shifting and you need more of the substance or the behavior to get the same type of reaction, the same pleasurable experience. So with pornography and with prostitutes, it just really hindered my ability to build relationships and to just engage with women. It really hindered my ability to see them as humans and not as, like, you know, objects of desire. And I just thought, like, if I am going through this, and obviously that led to me doing a lot of work in that area, you know, sure. But what I realized is, like, okay, I know this is a big taboo topic. Men don't really like talking about their sexuality and about, you know, just toxic masculinity in general, which to me is just another form of addiction. So, you know, I don't really lose anything by putting my story out there. I mean, I was already inspired by your story, by, you know, Brad Warner, by Noah Levine, et cetera, by all these authors who are kind of coming up. And there really isn't much talk about sex and about prostitution and about pornography. And I don't know, a big part of me is into, like, looking into these dark areas, looking into these taboos, these things that are not really being talked about, and kind of putting them out there. And with sexuality, that's a big part of I guess what I'm trying to communicate and kind of reach out to other men who are going through this but are really scared to talk about it, or I don't know, you know, there can be so many things getting in the way of that. And, you know, we're in the age of pornography right now. It's so easy to access pornography, and
sure,
and, you know, the effect it has when done compulsively, right? Because, you know, I know psychologists that work with their patients who are having premature ejaculation, and they have this whole therapy that involves pornography, probably a different type of pornography, but just the amount that there is available and the effects that it has, you know, on the brain, like as any addiction. I feel that sexuality is specifically important in this time, you know, with everything that's happening at the collective level, you know, this kind of dynamic interplay that's going on with the feminine and the masculine, and these conversations.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting time, for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an interesting time. I mean, did you feel like, I mean, I guess I got a couple of follow-up questions.
Yeah.
The first one is do you still drink? I mean, like, do you drink on a regular basis?
Not on a regular basis. But if I go out with, like, friends, I'll have, like, a beer, maximum two. And
so you feel like you've been able to sort of overcome the addiction or manage the addiction or something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I could see a very distinguishable difference in between how my relationship to alcohol was before and how it is now. And I don't know, I guess a different level of consciousness around its consumption. I mean, I can't say, you know, that that's going to be forever. I can't say that, you know, it can't become unbalanced, because it definitely can. But what I am taking responsibility for is this work, you know, this daily practice that I do and this constant mindfulness that I practice that then I can bring into, you know, having a drink, having a beer with my friends.
I obviously come from a little bit different of a background. I mean, maybe even closer to, like, what your father was, mm-hmm. or father is.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm, you know, and this is, you know, you can tell me if this is too personal or whatever, but how does your dad feel about, like, your addictions and then, like, you continue to drink?
Yeah.
Like, how does he feel about that?
Well, actually, you know, my parents were the first two people that I sent the book to, and there I really just expose everything. You know, my mom had a pretty quick reaction with my dad. It was more like I got home because I finished writing and then I published it while I was still traveling, and I got back home and, you know, there was kind of this, We weren't talking about it. We were talking about everything else except the book, until one time I just sat down and asked my dad, so what did you think about the book? And we started talking about it. And he expressed, concern about, like, he felt that in the book, I don't really talk about if I healed myself or if I am recovered, etc. And we started talking about, well, the whole second part of the book, part two, Reflections on Addiction, Love, and Self-Inquiry, is really where I draw information from other sources, from historians, anthropologists, psychologists, etc., to kind of put forth my ideas on this. And I never meant the book to be a handbook, like a guide. It's just the sharing of the story, and these are the insights that I've gained along the way. And we started getting into a conversation about the 12 steps and how the process that I was going through was in a way mirroring these 12 steps. So it was a pretty cool exchange that we had. I can't really tell if he's worried about me. You know, he also sees the work that I'm doing. And he's never really expressed any concern. So I couldn't really be able to talk on that, on exactly, sure, what he's feeling or what he's going through.
And so what do you feel about, like, or I guess maybe how did you kind of get the prostitution brothel thing under wraps as well? Like, how did you do that through mindfulness, or how did that kind of, like, because if you continue to drink, I'm wondering, like, how do you get these other addictions under control?
Yeah. I mean, that's a tricky one, because, I have talked a lot about the 12 steps with my dad, and I know celibacy, or abstinence, I guess. Abstinence is a big part of that. And part of what I talk about in the book is, alcohol is a very, very destructive force. But, what about something like sex, that if you have a partner, if you're in a relationship, it's probably a big, at least a part of the connection that, the two people have. Is it realistic to be abstinent from sex? And I'm saying this because, I had a girlfriend at one point, and then I was really into the whole yamas and niyamas thing, and I got into this mindset where, okay, I'm just going to try complete celibacy. And I've gone through periods of celibacy, like absolutely no masturbation, no orgasm, no pornography, no nothing. And the most that I did was three months, which is what this kind of support group online, which is nofap.com. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
No, I've never heard of it.
So it's just basically a support group for people who are struggling with porn addiction and with masturbation and all these things. They recommend 90 days of cleanse of total abstinence. So I tried that, and just trying out different things, being with a partner, deciding to be abstinent, being by myself, deciding to be abstinent. And what I realized is that with sex, it's complicated because it's a natural thing. It's like eating. It's like, if you're addicted to food, should you stop eating?
Right.
Or like, let's say, like, alcohol or beer in England or in Ireland, where it's so ingrained into the social fabric, like, is becoming abstinent, a solution for the alcoholism problem. And here's where I pull a lot from. You've probably heard of Dr. Gabor Mate.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So I really like how he kind of makes people own up to their responsibility in the addiction, and he's less about kind of pointing out the substances and the alcohol that's bad for you and the marijuana that's addictive, but more take a look inside and see, what problem are you trying to solve with these things. So I guess to go back to your question, how I've dealt with that is, okay, just really sit down and evaluate my relationship to sex. And what problem am I trying to solve with that? And that opened up a whole box of you know, attachments and unhealthy relationship dynamics and a lot of fears around the topic of being involved with somebody. And yeah. And this is, you know, this is something that I continue to look into, you know, as I'm sure, you know, you posted the other day. It's not like you do the 12 steps, you become sober, and then that's it. the work is done.
It's like, yeah. It's ever evolving. Like, it's more and more layers and all, you know, more step work, more all of that stuff. It never stops.
Yeah, exactly. So it kind of just shifts shape. I mean, now I meet girls and, you know, I don't do prostitutes anymore. But I'll meet girls and just really observe what I'm doing there. You know, how I am putting myself in these situations with a woman, etc., or somebody that I'm looking to get involved with, what am I trying to cover up? What insecurities or what, I don't know, what void, what emptiness am I trying to fill through somebody else? And I don't know, it's just this process of self-inquiry is what I call it. It's the only term that comes to my mind, sure, referring to it. And this constant questioning of why are you doing this? What are you trying to solve? It just brings a lot more mindfulness to it. I guess what I'm trying to say is that just because I'm not doing prostitutes anymore doesn't mean I can't possibly have an unhealthy relationship to sex or to women. I just have to bring a whole other level of consciousness to it. And okay, cool, I'm not doing prostitutes anymore, but how am I relating to the woman in my life right now?
Right. And so I'm wondering how, like, you've taken, because I know that you teach the Ashtanga method. I'm wondering how, like, you've kind of put that into practice and how that has helped you on the things that you've struggled with.
Yeah. Well,
or why maybe it works for you.
Yeah. You know, and the Mysore room is a pretty special place. And, you know, as a student, I felt like I got so much from the Mysore room, you know, regardless of what the teacher was doing, you know, regardless of the teacher-student dynamic, there was something about that space that felt sacred to me. And nowadays, when I'm teaching, you know, as beautiful as any student can be, for some reason, like, I see people differently in there, right? I don't see people, students in, when I'm like going to adjust somebody, maybe if that's even necessary. I'm a lot more mindful of it, and I feel like it's coming more from a loving place than from wanting to get something out of this person. It's more like I get into this mindset of serving, of helping, and of facilitating. So once I'm in that paradigm, it just shifts the way that I see things. So I don't really, I guess I don't.
Is it more like you're teaching, or do you think that it's the practice plus teaching that, like, kind of shifts that perspective for you?
It's the practice plus teaching, you know, because teaching gives you a whole broader spectrum of what this practice is doing. It definitely has helped me kind of go deeper into the effects of the practice, and how it works just on different personalities, different, I don't know, Ayurvedic constitutions, different builds of people. So I think it's a combination of both, because what I'm getting from that experience from teaching is informing me so much. It's kind of my own. I feel like I'm practicing as well, which I'm sure you can relate to. Like, I'm practicing in there with them. And the fact that I feel like it's a sacred space, that somehow, you know, that's where my mind is at. That's where my drishti is at, you can say.
Right.
Yeah, so the topic of sex doesn't come into the Mysore room. Probably outside, yes. But yeah, that's something that I am.
But how do you think it's helped you with your addiction?
Oh, okay. How kind of the practice? Well, I feel
and also teaching too, Ian. Like, you know, like how do those two things manifest themselves as Ian being a better person and like, you know, helping dealing with this addiction?
Mm-hmm. I feel that any tool that'll bring up the stuff that we're not wanting to see necessarily, or that will create the circumstance for inner exploration, is going to inadvertently be helpful in recovering from addiction, right? And I know you're writing a book on the relationship that Ashtanga has, or I don't know if it's Ashtanga or maybe yoga with the 12 steps. I got this from your episode in Dharma Talks with Henry Winslow. I might be wrong. Yeah. But, you know, you've obviously seen there's a relationship happening there with the conversations I've had with my dad. I also see that there is a lot of things that are intertwined. I mean, to me, the 12 steps, to me, there's like a big jump from the first to the second, you know, from the first, which is like really, accepting that you're powerless. Right.
Yep.
To the second, which is immediately having this connection with a higher power.
Right.
Yeah. So to me, I feel that's where yoga comes in, because I feel like it's very difficult to just come to somebody and tell them, hey, you know what? You have a problem. First of all, you know, that's a whole topic in and of itself. Then secondly, okay, right. Not only do you have a problem, but you need to believe in something greater than yourself. Like, to me, that is very difficult. And the Mysore room has this way of silently teaching that, of silently not even teaching it, of giving the person a personal experience of that, a personal experience of, okay, well, there's something wrong with me maybe, or something that I'm not looking at, and immediately like, I feel like something else is maybe taking control as I'm moving through these motions, moving with my breath, or maybe sitting still, and just breathing.
You're right. Yeah, it's just really fascinating to, you know, to hear you, because like you're coming at it from like a very different perspective, you know, like and different is not good. And honestly, like the amount of rawness that you've shared, like, you know, just being like completely vulnerable is also inspiring, because I just feel like there's just this huge amount of work that people have to do. And it seems like you're doing that work. It's pretty amazing, man. You know, so
I really appreciate it, Taylor. And though, and you know, it's not an easy thing. I mean, you've done really good questions, man. I wasn't expecting, you know. I mean, I know you work with other people, and I know that you were gonna really look into my story. You know, in the sense that probably how you listen to other addicts' stories, you know, and kind of see through the stuff, because in our stories, we can really point out, you know, where we might be a little hesitant, where we're maybe being a little bit dishonest. So I did expect a little bit of that, you know, of, you know, oh shit, I'm going to talk with Taylor. So, you know, it's probably going to bring up a bunch of stuff, and you know, that's what's happening. And that's what I'm here for, honestly. I mean, that's part of the work that I'm doing. And I feel like if I can be, you know, this open, then it'll help others be open and kind of look into themselves as well and have these kinds of questions.
Yeah. Well, okay. So tell us a little bit about where we can get the book and how people can get in contact with you.
Sure. Well, the book's available on Amazon. You can get it through my website. It's yogaaroundtheworld.com. And then, yeah, my Instagram is just at Ian Pescod, all together. And I just recently translated the book to Spanish, so it's going to be arriving to Panama pretty soon. So I'm going to be working on that, promoting it, and I'm also teaching here classes in Panama.
Yeah, where do you teach at?
Well, I'm teaching just at this creative space. It's called Unicadoverse. It's kind of a collaboration I'm doing with this girl that does handmade like handkerchiefs. Like silk handkerchiefs. It's become very trendy here in Panama, and she's doing really well. And I saw that she was doing a couple of yoga classes, so I reached out to her. And after a couple of conversations, we agreed on having a program there just in the evenings. So that's what I'm doing. I'm not teaching in the mornings, only in the evenings.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, Ian, I really appreciate being on the show and being vulnerable. And, you know, I'm going to check out your book. I appreciate you giving me a copy of it. And, you know, it's sort of a breath of fresh air to hear you on the podcast and like doing the work that you're doing. Keep it up, man.
Thanks so much, Taylor. I really appreciate it. It means a lot.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.